All right, thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Gaucho Amigos. I'm Alex. Today, my guest is Andy Cush. He's a music and culture writer, currently a contributing editor at Pitchfork. His work has also appeared in GQ and many other major publications. He's also a musician. He plays bass in the excellent indie rock band Garcia Peoples, who I believe are about to head out on tour. He's very prolific, and I already knew Andy prior to this conversation. This was not our first time meeting. We have mutual friends, including a close friend and former guest of this podcast, Winston Cook Wilson. And Andy and Winston are currently, along with singer-songwriter Katie Battistoni, collaborating on a new Steely Dan cover band project. They're called Katie and the Liars. They're just a four-piece rock band, you know, playing the hits. And I did get the chance to see them recently. They performed at Tubby's in Kingston, New York a few weeks ago. It was a great show and a very fun night. And I should mention that this conversation was recorded prior to that show. So you may hear a couple references to it as an upcoming event. But anyway, we talked all about the process of covering Steely Dan and a whole lot more. So without further ado, this is my conversation with Andy Cush. Enjoy.
My first appreciation of it was like, oh, kind of ironic, I guess, you know, of like, oh, this is like the sound of like cocaine in the 70s. And it's like so slick and it's some kind of funny. And I'm listening to it like on that level because I felt like I was like playing a character by like, you know, drinking some whiskey and putting Asia on. And then at a certain point, it crossed over to like, no, actually, this is like the greatest music I've ever heard. And free of irony, you know.
Yeah, the same thing happened to me for sure.
Yeah.
Like our mutual friend Winston, you know, he was a fan, you know, well before I was and would always talk about how great they were. But I thought he was kind of joking on some level, like,
well, with Winston, it's hard to tell whether he's joking or not in any given moment.
Yeah, that's true. But so, yeah, I was kind of riding that line. And then I think he was also, when he tried to get me into them, he kind of, he posited as a little bit of a joke, I think, as a way to get me to that point where I would just listen to them. And then from there, we kind of got really seriously into them.
Around the time that I was first becoming friends with Winston, our mutual friend, he played a show where, as sort of like a bit at the end of the show, he had brought like all these CDs that he like didn't want anymore and was like either giving them away at the merch table or like it might have been even like incorporated into the performance somehow. They're like these CDs of Steely Dan's discography that like, it's like the first one has all of Can't Buy a Thrill and like the first half of Countdown to Ecstasy or something. And then it's like a box set of their whole discography, but for some reason it isn't separated like actually album by album, you know?
I think it's like Citizen Steely Dan or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah. I got, I think the first two CDs of that from Winston, which of course he, as I'm sure you know, is like an infamous hater on like the sort of early Steely Dan. So I guess that's why he was offloading those. So then it was like, I was obsessed with Asia for years and years. And then it was like Can't Buy a Thrill and Countdown to Ecstasy, which kind of appealed to me on like, and I of course knew like the hits from those records and stuff, but like, obviously there's all kinds of stuff you can talk about regarding like the kind of compositional sophistication and how good all the players are and all that. But for me, it was just like the songs were just hitting on a more kind of basic intuitive level than that. Like, I just thought that they were cool. You know, like, like I remember just hearing like Deacon Blues and just thinking like, this is just a great song, you know? And something, I guess that kind of ironic appreciation thing that I was, you know, that I feel like a lot of people our age kind of start with them, like, you know, some of that is actually baked into like the songwriting. You know, like there is, of course, like there can be a pretty high degree of irony in the writing itself. And I think that like the sort of like shadowy world of like losers and ne'er-do-wells and drug addicts and things like that kind of appealed to me as like somebody who you know, I like noir detective stories and Thomas Pynchon and stuff like that. And I feel like there's a certain kind of like post hippie crossed with like LA noir thing that I you know, like the Altman Long Goodbye movie and stuff like that. Like there's like this particular sensibility that I'm really attracted to, that I feel like some of the kind of writing of characters and stuff in Steely Dan songs like feels aligned with. And so that was something that I really liked as well.
Yeah, I've noticed a lot of like people who, call themselves like cinephiles or just kind of like film buffs, tend to be really drawn to Steely Dan, or even if they're not like big music heads, like Steely Dan's one of the bands they'll listen to. And it makes total sense because it's kind of like the same thing in a lot of ways. Like they're narrators, they're telling stories, and the stories are about, kind of like you said, like, there's this sort of almost post-apocalyptic kind of noir shadowy feel to them. So I think it's an easy jump to make.
And I think also like the way that like the musical settings are kind of like interacting with the writing in a similar manner that like the kind of visual style of a film is like complementing and heightening the the material of the script or whatever.
Yeah. Like a horn line will emphasize, a line that Donald sung in the same way that maybe the score in a movie would, reflect like the character's motivations or feelings in a particular moment.
Yeah, totally. There's like the great the Alex Papadimus piece about Gaucho, and I see his book on the shelf behind you.
Yeah.
But there's like one of my favorite lines in like any music writing is like something about in Babylon Sisters, he's talking about the character and he's like, and muted trumpets are mocking him in the way that only muted trumpets can, or something like that.
Right, they're like wow, 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 which is like a total, it's a total noir kind of vibe when you hear that whole song in general. But yeah, that moment is great. Yeah, I also think of like the something about the chord change in Hey 19, like the dun dun. There's something very like smirking about it that just it also like to me reflects the narrator's like feeling in the song. That album is just like suffused with moments like that. So now you're playing Steely Dan. How'd that all start?
I guess that started my girlfriend Katie Battistoni is like an incredible shredding guitar player who can play jazz, rock and roll. You know, she has a skill set that is like very, it's well aligned with playing Steely Dan music. And she had for years done different with a different band she plays in, had done like different tributes. The Gutter, people, anyone in Brooklyn is listening might know, is this like bowling alley slash rock venue, which every Halloween they have a little festival of people covering like other, you know, big bands music. And Katie had done that every year with like different Queen, Led Zeppelin, et cetera. And this year she was like, let's do Steely Dan. And I guess, you know, me and Winston, who has the great band Office Culture, big Steely Dan head. I guess he and I were like natural choices for her to play with. And the drummer has been sort of a rotating seat just based on availability, but the upcoming one is this amazing drummer, Ryan Jewell, who is a good friend of mine and has played in lots of awesome bands. Yeah, and I guess it kind of started as like, let's just do this for fun. And then we got offered to do this Tubby's thing, which is like, I've played it in my other band before and it's just a great time. And we're like, all right, let's take this as an excuse to like, we had only learned like six songs before, and now we're like playing for an hour and a half or something. And
I went to one show where you played, I think, five songs.
yeah, that sounds right.
So that was maybe the first one or something. But yeah, so you've worked your way up to an hour and a half at this point. Damn.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe a little less. I think we have like 15 that we're gonna do. And it's like I think anyone who's into the band kind of understands like the notion that it is like challenging music to play. And I feel like I understand that on an entirely more kind of real level now that I'm actually learning it. Some of the stuff is like, I'll like beat myself up. I play bass and I'll like beat myself up over how difficult something is. And I'm like, oh wait, this is like, there's a bunch of different people playing bass, but like for instance, like, okay, this is Chuck Rainey, probably who's like one of the greatest bass guitarists who ever lived. And he probably did like 30 takes, and this is the best one. And so like it's okay if I'm like having a hard time with it, But yeah, I mean, some of the stuff is like really nuts.
Yeah, but I remember when I was getting really into Steely Dan. I mean, I'm a very novice piano player. My main instrument is actually the viola, but in terms of
Oh, cool.
an instrument I could play Steely Dan on, piano was next. So
Yeah.
I bought the Easy Piano Steely Dan book, but it was still pretty challenging because the chord
Yeah.
voicings were just like very hard to do. And I was kind of, I hadn't played in a long time. So I remember just sitting there like trying to learn the opening chords of Deacon Blues for like, sit there for like an hour trying to get
I
it
mean,
right. And then,
that song in particular is insane with the chords in it. Yeah.
And I
And like
think Babylon Sisters, I like also tried. And it's just like,
another crazy one, yeah.
so you're doing these songs as a four piece. It's not going to
Yeah.
have the spectrum of instruments
Yeah.
that the records have. What's your approach in terms of, making it sound like the song?
Well, it's mostly like Katie, who plays guitar, and Winston, who plays keys, have most of the burden for that. I mean, a lot of it is Katie learning horn lines on guitar. And
I think she played the
doing
Dirty Work sax solo as a guitar
she
solo
did
when I saw you guys. Yeah, I remember that.
and yeah, that's the main thing, honestly. And we like talked about so first off, she has a really voracious appetite for like learning and mastering whatever music you want to throw at her. So I think it's a challenge that she enjoys, being like, not only am I going to play the guitar stuff, but I'm going to play the horn stuff too. And she's good at it. And we also kind of had a conversation at the beginning of like, we could do the kind of like jazz school aspirational version of this band where we just like try to make it as slick as possible and it'll be like so much work, and it already is a lot of work. Or we could kind of have the attitude of like, no, fuck it, we're like a quartet and we're doing not exactly like the punk rock version of Steely Dan, but the like bar band, sort of stripped down version of it. And we opted to do the second one, in part because we just like, it's like we like the people. It's like this band is fun. We don't need to like bring more people in. And also it kind of like gives us a bit of I feel like there's a bit of grace that we have of like if we fuck stuff up, it's like, oh yeah, well, they don't even have a saxophone player. But that being said, we're trying to do it. We are not trying to fuck up. We want it to be like really, really solid and good.
Yeah, I mean, it's more, almost more interesting to do it that way, just to have a different take on the music and see how much you can really get the song in, even with only, four people. Like, it's an impressively ambitious thing to do. And I think, yeah, I think your approach is good. There's actually this great, I don't know if you've seen it, but about, I don't know, I want to say 10, 12 years ago, there was this, I think it was the AV Club did a series where they had like indie rock bands come in and like spontaneously cover songs that they picked off some sort of board. Do
I
you remember
remember that
this?
series, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great series. And there was a band called Hospitality did a cover of Ricky Don't Lose That Number in a kind of almost the punk rock version, and it was
Cool.
tremendous. You got to
Nice.
check it out. Yeah, I mean, it might be inspirational. Like, I it was a totally unique take on the song. And I have never
Cool.
seen any Steely Dan song done that way. So yeah,
Nice. That's cool. Yeah,
highly recommend that. Yeah.
that's one that, I could see working that way.
Yeah.
It has a lot of chords in it, but like they're mostly chords that don't have like crazy jazz voicings and stuff. You could like do power chords and it would still work.
Yeah, are you more inclined to do the earlier albums, songs off the earlier ones, just for that reason?
I mean, it is sort of like a guitar-centric vision of Steely Dan. And, I mean, there's great guitar shit on all their records, but definitely like on when we were doing like the very short set, it was like our kind of greatest asset as a band is the shredding guitar player we have, so we're like, let's use that. But now, I mean, we're at least like up through Gaucho for the bigger set that we're putting together, we're doing at least one or two from every record. And it's a pretty like good I think that we're covering every like era through 1980 like pretty fairly.
Yeah. In theory, would you do any of the solo album stuff, or is that outside the
Maybe eventually,
yeah
it's like
or
we're so this is gig number three that we're doing,
yeah.
so it's like there's a lot like I love 11 Tracks of Whack. It would be cool to do something from that.
Nice.
And yeah, or the Fagen Solo Records, which I have to admit, like I am not super, super familiar with all that stuff.
Okay.
Even with like the post reunion albums, I know them, but I don't like know them well. But yeah, for now, it's kind of like we're doing like
That makes sense.
the crowd pleasing version of the Steely Dan set, but with, there will be plenty of people in the crowd who have never heard, like, I don't know, Time Out of Mind or something,
Yeah.
which will, so there's like, there will be ones within the scope of the original run. We're trying to do some like deep cuts as well.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Tracks of Whack. I mean, that's going very deep. So not many people, even like on my like Steely Dan Twitter world, like not many people have heard that album. So.
Yeah, that's. I that's another so I have to admit Winston is responsible for like
yeah,
huge chunks of my taste in music, and that was another one that he just kind of hipped me to like a few years ago.
it was a hard case, just another hard case. Yeah, it was a hard case, just another hard.
I mean, I've been playing bass for a long time, and it's, I'm pretty serious about it. I like have played for years, and I play in bands that tour and stuff, and but I just never had played in a context that slapping would be required or welcomed, you know. Like I play in like indie rock bands and stuff. And so I never had good reason to learn it. And then when we were doing this, the original gigs with this Steely Dan band, we were playing Peg, which has some really awesome slapping that Chuck Rainey does in the chorus of that song. And so not only did I have to like learn how to play this song, but I also like had to kind of start from the very beginning on just the technique of slapping itself. And
so the impetus for learning this was because you were covering Peg.
Yeah, exactly.
And you wanted to honor Chuck's part.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a cool, I mean, it's cool because it's like not a part that's really like screaming at you at the top of the mix, but it is like such a cool, once you like hear it, it's such a cool thing. And I don't think like, I think that not doing that would have been like would have been a disservice to the song. So yeah, that was why I learned to play slap bass, like, I don't know, last year. And, I still don't have like very many opportunities outside of playing Steely Dan music to really like, you know, be slapping away in like other music that I'm playing, but it was cool to learn how to do it. And I had just put something on Twitter, like, I forget exactly what I said, but just like some joke about like, now that I've learned how to slap, it's going to take like Zen like restraint to like not be just like slapping all the time in these like highly inappropriate contexts. And an editor at GQ who I had just like, I'd worked with in other contexts before and I have known him for a few years, just like emailed me and was like, I think it would be really fun if you wanted to write a piece about learning to play slap bass for GQ. And I was like, I had not thought about that at all, but I was like, yeah, that sounds like it would be really fun. So
do you think there's a stigma against it?
I think that now less so than there used to be, you know, like in the same way that like steel, like you could use slap bass as a sort of, I don't know, little synecdoche for Steely Dan or something, where it's like Steely Dan has like, I would say like the kind of cultural like coolness of slap bass has probably proceeded along like a fairly similar route as the cultural coolness of Steely Dan.
Well, Donald and Walter didn't want slapping either.
That's true.
I'm sure you know the story. Yeah,
I do. Yeah. which I talk about in the piece.
Yeah.
Funny thing. This is a sort of tangent around that, but I recently was learning Kid Charlemagne on bass because we're playing it at our next gig. And I feel like Peg has a reputation among like bass heads or whatever as like the big, you know, that's like the great like Chuck Rainey showcase of their catalog. But I think Kid Charlemagne is actually like, it's way harder than Peg.
Yeah.
And he slaps on that. And I was like, oh, it didn't occur to me until learning that like they already had one song in their catalog that Chuck was slapping on before. People don't know the whole thing with Peg is that Chuck Rainey wanted to play slap on that. They didn't want him to. And he was so like set on the idea that he like set up a baffle in the studio and like turned away from the control room so that he could slap without them seeing him doing it. And like, that's what ended up on the song. But yeah, like as far as is there a cultural stigma around it? I feel like it's like, you know, things like, I mean, this isn't that recent at this point, but like, you know, like the Destroyer Kaput album, for instance, or like the second Bon Iver album. And I don't know if either of those even have slapping on them, but there's stuff. It's like, there was like this whole wave of like, oh, slick, soft rock music is actually cool.
Right.
And I feel like we're still kind of living in the moment where that's true. And so now I feel like I'm sure a lot of people still hear slapping and they're like, that's ridiculous, or they think it's funny or whatever, but there's at least more of an understanding that like the kind of sounds of that era like are actually not just ironic and funny, but like are actually cool as hell.
Yeah, the fandom thing, I mean, that's the part of doing this that I'm like kind of uncomfortable about, because I never really aspired to be a fandom person. Do you know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
It kind of makes me uncomfortable. But what I don't like is when I say something negative and people, it's interesting. It's like, there's a couple things that happen. Sometimes when I say something negative about a song or a person that was involved with Steely Dan, people get really angry at me for saying that. They're very protective of like all, like they want it they only want positivity. Like only want me to say good things no matter what, which rubs me the wrong way. But
totally,
I think that's how these things work, unfortunately. And then there's also like a protect the leader mentality with Donald.
Uh-huh.
Like, what Donald says is how it goes. Like there's anything that hasn't been authorized by Donald is just completely. So the Quantum Criminals book, there were a bunch of fans, they were all like refused to read Quantum Criminals, and it's the reason absurd. Which is totally fucking insane because it's a great book, but the reason is that I think it was the combination, like Donald hasn't commented on it or signed off on it, and Donald's thing a little bit has been like he didn't want people reading too much into the lyrics,
right.
So a whole book that's mainly focused on interpreting the lyrics of Steely Dan songs to them is like sacrilegious. It's weird. It's almost like, it's like we're talking about like the Bible or something. Like there's almost, you know, it's,
yeah, but like even the Bible is like, you know, there are volumes and volumes of interpretation of the Bible. Anytime like someone takes that attitude about art that they like, my feeling is that you're actually sort of trying to delegitimize it.
I mean,
you're not trying to, but that's what you're doing in effect. Because, I don't know, like...
You're saying it's above interpretation, basically, right?
Yeah, and if no one's sort of opinion on this artwork or their interpretation of it matters other than the creators, then what's the artwork worth? Like, then it's just something that's totally, if you're taking that view of an artwork, then it's like, then the person just made it out of indulgence and selfishness. And it's not like, it's not worth thinking about for anyone other than the creator. I just don't get it. There was a great quote from Alex Papademos about that book, which I thought about like often since reading. It was like an interview he did with NPR about it, where he addresses that line of thinking about not reading too much into the lyrics directly. Basically, he's like, okay, well, you could take Fagan's view and just say, oh, this is just like a made up story. But like anyone who makes up a story, if it's any good, is like putting some of their own experience into it. And if the song Gaucho is about this like mysterious figure who seems kind of like an embodiment of hedonism, who's like kind of coming in between two people and driving them apart, like the two guys who made this record, like one of them was in the depths of heroin addiction and the other one was trying to hold it together and make something with him still, like it's actually like a really poignant way to think about that song that might like seem kind of silly or just fantastical otherwise. And I had never really thought about Steely Dan songs in terms of like personal content before, and I don't know, that for me like offered a whole new way of thinking about them, even if it's not the way that like Donald Fagan wants me to think about them. Like I don't really care.
I read that was in the book, right? The Gaucho piece where he talks how he interprets the relationship between the narrator and not the Gaucho but the guy who brings the Gaucho as being
exactly
kind of Donald and Walter.
Right.
Yeah, it's a really interesting way to think about it. Do you have any other songs that you have like a particular, I don't know, it doesn't have to be an interesting interpretation, but a song that you just particularly like or think about? Or
one that comes to mind is Dr. Wu. That's like my favorite. I don't know, some days I would say that's my favorite Steely Dan song.
Me too.
And nice, cool.
I
and also definitely my favorite like piece of writing in their catalog. I just find like the story, there's so much kind of left out of the story, as you know, it's not that long of a song. There's only two verses, I think. But just the kind of way it turns from the first verse to the second verse, and the sort of little images that are kind of brought back from the first verse into the second verse, now kind of in the through the lens of this like pained memory, and like, I don't know, it just gives me such a rich sense of like this complicated, I guess, love triangle. And just some of the kind of the details of setting, you know, the Cuban gentleman sleeping all day, and it just I don't know, there's something about that song that's really like magical to me, and it's kind of even hard to talk about why.
Yeah.
And then of course, like, it wouldn't be so great if it weren't also like just this beautiful song as a piece of music.
Totally.
Yeah, I guess that was one, you know, you don't think of, I mean, at least I think a lot of people don't think of Steely Dan's music as being particularly like emotional, but that one is really, really sad and beautiful to me. I mean, there's some that I just love on the, like Black Cow, for instance, I love on the level of like groove, you know,
yeah.
And it just has a feeling, you know, it's just like, you know, I make my own music too, and something that I'm really fascinated with, and I don't know exactly how it's done, is like something that, like, as soon as it comes on, it just makes you feel good, you know?
Yeah.
And that's like an ideal. If I could make like one song that's like, that carries that sense of just like, you hear it and everything is okay in the world, like, I'd be very happy, you know? And they have, of course, a million songs like that. There's one more I wanted to say. And then, like, I mentioned it already, but because I'm in the middle of learning it right now, like, Kid Charlemagne is like, just the level of like, again, they have a lot of songs like this, but like the level of kind of musical complexity and trickery and like weird but great ideas that went into that song, but that are sort of played off as if they're nothing, you know, like, and it's just this pop song, is just, that's also something to which to aspire for me. Like, it's like the coolest music of all, it's like the hippest music of all time, but it's just presented as if it's like just a fun thing to listen to, you know?
Yeah, it's true.
I just think that's really the way that their way of just being unshowy about their own kind of like level of compositional ability is really cool to me.
Yeah, I feel like songs like Kid Charlemagne and Peg, and even, you know, Hey 19, you know, they, you would never know, you know, the level of detail that went into crafting those songs if you heard them, you know, like at the supermarket. And I didn't for years.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you take the deep dive or whatever, and you get really obsessive, and you start to hear what it took to make those songs sound the way they do, and how they're different than all the other, you know, music that came out, you know, around that time, which a lot of it is great, but it's just different, you know. It doesn't offer, to me personally, it doesn't have the same, quite the same level of just richness or like, you know, repeat value, I guess. I don't know.
We were talking about, we had rehearsal for the Steely Dan Band yesterday, and we were, one of the songs we were working on yesterday was Time Out of Mind. And the bridge of that song, otherwise the song, I mean, it's That song is pretty simple in the scheme of Steely Dan, in terms of like its chords and form and stuff. But the bridge is like very weird, with the rhythms, and there's one or two particularly like pungent, kind of strange chords in it. But again, it just like is this like really delightful, breezy sounding thing. And like, I feel like people get mad at Steely Dan for like being so good or something, or just being so like fastidious about their music that it seems like snobby or something. And I'm sure those guys could be like snobby for real, but like stuff like that, for me, it's like they didn't have to put as much effort as they did into the bridge of Time Out of Mind, Steve. Like
Right.
they could have just as easily turned it in with this part, like this part that you could hear a million times without really thinking very much about. They could have turned in like a dumber version of that and it would have been fine, you know? But it's like the fact that they were like always putting extra attention to detail in their music, like more than they needed to. Sure, you could look at that as them like punishing their session players or whatever, but my preferred way of looking at it is like a sort of generosity of like, we are going to make this thing, if you're going to pay for our record, we're going to make it as good as it could possibly fucking be, you know? I don't know, that's really cool to me.
There was this turn that happened, and it started like, I don't know, maybe like 7 or 8 years ago. And I think you wrote a piece about this, how the sort of the punk indie world did a sort of 180 on the Grateful Dead and then Steely Dan, and it kind of happened at the same time. Do you think that there's something in that, or I mean,
Do you know that like there's that funny little infographic that I think like that Donald maybe made about things that are like
the Dan
dead
to
head
Dead
coded and
conversion. Yeah.
So
Yeah, it
like
was like
even from do you know when that is from?
some of the 90s.
Yeah, so even then there was some sense, at least to him, that there was like a similar, that there were like maybe, I don't know, they're almost, they're kind of like mirror images of each other. Like Steely Dan basically after a certain point never playing live, Grateful Dead being a band that like only really, I mean they made albums and some of them are good, but like the main legacy of that band is like their live shows and you know, they're bands that like the for which like instrumental, different kinds of like instrumental sophistication are like really important. I mean, there's plenty of things that are very different also, but yeah, I don't, I guess part of the turn maybe is like just that for a while to like the average punk or indie rock person, like this was like the hokiest stuff you could possibly up with. I'd like to think it's more, there's more to it than that.
Do you think it's because the music was more complex than like a punk rock song? Do you know what I mean? Like, obviously, with Steely Dan and then even the Dead, you know, when they get into those long jams, it sometimes, you know, verges into the territory of being having the complexity of jazz or something. So.
Yeah, totally. And I feel like, you know, maybe there's something about like when I'm really just kind of like flying by the seat of my pants here, but
Didn't mean to put you on the spot.
no, it's okay. It's interesting.
Yeah,
I'm just saying like I may end up saying something that
that's
isn't true, but
okay.
you know, like okay, when indie rock first kind of like emerges in like, I don't know, the late 80s or the early 90s, it really came out of like hardcore, you know. And so like punk was this ethos that was kind of like the at the core of it for a really long time. And then eventually the opportunities to be like a mainstream rock musician, if you're not like Imagine Dragons or something, hollowed out so thoroughly. And it's like people who like the world of indie has gotten to be so broad because there's no, like, it's just what rock and roll is now, you know.
There's almost no unifying ethos the same way.
Because like people who were into Steely Dan and shit in earlier decades would like maybe have like gotten to tried to like get signed to a major label or something, and now the opportunities for that are so limited that it's like, okay, well, if all of us are going to be in like indie together, like I think about somebody like our friend Winston, where it's like, there's like, Winston is not like a punk dude at all. And I don't mean that disparagingly at all, but it's like, yeah, there has to be a room. There has to be room in indie music for someone. And Winston is fucking brilliant in my opinion, but it's like, no, indie is no longer this like hardcore driven alternative to everything else that's happening in rock music. It's just like the only game in town.
Right.
So maybe part of it is just like, well, people who are interested in this kind of music, like this is what their home is now. But then also, yeah, there is this like aesthetic. People are realizing that the even just on a surface level, the aesthetics of the thing are just cool. And I don't know what that is. Maybe that's just nostalgia cycles, but it's like,
like
the iconography of the Grateful Dead is fucking cool. And like Steely Dan's music just sounds good, you know? And like, I don't know, that's maybe just a matter of shifting tastes. And maybe our generation is just getting older and we're like open. We're not clinging to the like idea that things have to be like raw and authentic in this really narrowly defined way in order to be good. I don't know. I could talk about that for a long time. Cut myself off there.
No, that's okay. I mean, go as long as you want. I mean, I feel like a band like Steely Dan could never happen now because two guys writing those songs would never get have the resources now
totally.
That they had then.
Yeah, and maybe that's a part of the appeal too, is like, let's treasure this moment of possibility when records like this could even be made.
It's kind of what's happened in the film industry too, which is like, you know, directors with the kind of visions of like a Coppola, you know, or something, don't have the budgets that they had, you know, with like the studios back in the 70s. So everything is kind of like, any director, I mean, there's a handful of exceptions, but like, you know, someone like, I don't know, Robert Eggers or something, you know, it's just like, that's indie, right? That's indie just because it's weird or it's not doing something that's like a comic book movie or, I mean, there's a few every year.
Right.
It's like, you can count on one hand how many like, you know, kind of directors with quote unquote vision actually get like studio money now.
Yeah. Which was, you know, you mentioned Robert Eggers. That was, I guess this movie's kind of polarizing for fans of his, but I loved The Northman.
The Northman, yeah, that was kind of like the closest thing to that's probably ever get.
That's what I mean. Is like, it's cool, and I don't know if there was that. Did you read the New Yorker article that was a profile of him, like while he was making The Northman?
It was like a nightmare, right?
Yeah, and it was also, it's just, he was like very acutely aware of what you just said, of like, this is my one shot at making something this big. It's a really interesting piece to see, to like get inside someone's head who is in that particular scenario and knows that that's the scenario that they're in.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I don't think it did very well at the box office. So
yeah.
It was a cool movie. I dug it. I really like his movies in general, but yeah, I mean,
so do I.
An example of just someone who, you know, maybe in the 70s, you know, and again, different medium than music, but it's sort of happening all over, you know.
Yeah, totally.
I don't know. Yeah. The Grateful Dead thing is interesting, though, because, well, I was actually going to bring up the fact that you're in a band that's ostensibly indie rock, but, you know, you probably lean more on the, like I would say the Grateful Dead is probably a bigger influence. And I could be wrong, this is just my own take, but the Grateful Dead is probably a bigger influence than, like, a hardcore band.
Yeah, our like relationship to the Grateful Dead is sort of tortured, honestly, because it's like, we do like, okay, so I'm playing a band called Garcia People, so obviously there is a signal of a certain association with the Dead there that is not like entirely misleading. Like, we are a rock band that like jams on stage, but on the other hand, I also, you know, I wasn't involved in the naming of the band. I sort of wish we had a different name.
For that reason. But
yeah, because, you know, people will come up and be like, I thought you, that didn't sound like Jerry Garcia, you know.
Because
like
they want jam band music, which is kind of its own thing.
Right. And like we have like a foot in the world and the sort of industry of indie rock, and another foot in like the world and the outskirts of the industry of jam band music. And sometimes there's a certain kind of jam band fan. I mean, first off, we're not for everybody. And like, I don't expect that everyone who hears our music would like it, you know, but like, there's certain like people who are into Phish, but like also are record collectors or listen to WFMU or whatever. Like, that's kind of our, like, a lot of our audience is people like that.
Really?
But then we've played in front of like really like straight down the middle jam band audiences before.
You've done like the festivals, the jam band festivals?
We have done a few of them.
Really? Yeah. Interesting. I didn't think I realized that.
Yeah. Like we've done festivals where it's like, it feels like the Gathering of the Juggalos or something.
And I've heard of these festivals. I don't attend them myself, but I know what they are.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
the,
yeah.
The Phish world of music. It's a totally different thing than like India.
And, you know, we don't always do great in front of an audience like that.
Why not?
I don't know that much about jam band music, but I guess I maybe know more about it than like the average indie rock person just because of the band I play in. There's definitely like post Phish and post like Disco Biscuits and like music, I guess the music that came after Phish, which is like kind of all of it, is indebted to Phish in some way or another. Like funk is a big kind of part of the cocktail. And now even like that sort of turns into like EDM also being part of it. We're not like a dance band, you know, or we don't know, like we don't have like,
people aren't twirling at your shows, right?
Yeah. And like, I like dance music. I don't, and I love dancing to music also. But like, our strength as a band isn't like that sort of playing that sort of danceable groove for like a long stretch. And that's like a big part of like the what you're supposed to do as a jam band, basically.
Because it's not too common that you sort of have a foot in these two worlds, which are really different.
No, it's a very weird, or it's like it's a fascinating place to find ourselves. And sometimes I'm like, man, I wish we could just be like a regular. I wish we had a different name and we would just be like a regular indie rock band.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'm like, no, this is cool. Like we are reaching certain, like there's certain audiences that do dig us where I'm like, we wouldn't have found these people who are into our music had it not been for this kind of like tangential relationship to the jam world that we have. And also I just think that it's like, it's this huge, really thriving part of the music industry that like for a lot of people might as well not exist at all, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting to like have a bit of a window on it. We were talking about yesterday at rehearsal, like kind of like the notion of like jamming on Steely Dan music. And there are certain parts that are like, I guess a good example is like in Kid Charlemagne. I'm sorry, I keep bringing this up, but we were drilling that song heavily yesterday. So it's on my mind. There's like the two different guitar solos. And the first, like, you know, there's the one in the middle of the song, and then there's like the outro one. And the first one is like these pretty elaborate, you know, it starts in classic Steely Dan fashion where the guitar solo is happening over chord changes that don't happen anywhere else in the song, which is, you know, they like to do that. And like, it's a fairly elaborate set of chord changes that go back and forth between like new material and like restating sections of the song form. And to stretch that out would be like really difficult and would be like a really challenge. It would be like a real challenge for a soloist because the chords are just unusual, you know. And then like the outro, you can even hear Larry Carlton. He sounds so much like looser on the outro because it's just like this vamp that's like pretty easy to solo over, you know. And like I think that like some Steely Dan stuff would be really challenging to turn into like jam band vehicles because of the fact that the chord changes are so wild. It's like most Grateful Dead songs are like the chord changes in the jam sections. I mean, sometimes they're just like abandoning chord changes and that is its own really cool thing. But usually if like a jam is structured around chords, it's like easy chords to play.
Yep.
And I don't mean that as like a dig on the Dead at all. I love the Dead. But like some of the Dan stuff, it's like, if you really want to stretch out like Deacon Blues or something, that would be like, I don't know, that would be like a massive challenge just to do like that one song, you know?
I guess the other side of it is also just like, is it just stupid to do Steely Dan as a jam band? You know what I mean? Like, is just that just a bad idea? Because like the cool thing about Steely Dan is how they were able to take all these, you know, musical ideas from so many different places and kind of put and turn them into sort of this perfectly crafted song.
Right.
So I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there's also the thing you run into of like, you're not going to come up with better stuff to play than like Wayne Shorter did, you know? Or whoever.
Right. Like when they did stretch things out, it was like the greatest musicians of all time doing
it.
So.
Remember, this was kind of a written bass part, but he fixed it up in his own.
Parts of it were written.
Right.
This part was written.
Mm.
This verse part. Just a great musician. Slapping and also fretting with his thumb. Chuck had a really unique. But here's the chorus, which was.
You'd have to ask Chuck about the thumb business, you know.
They didn't want me to slap, I think mainly because at that time, slapping was just becoming popular. And it was on a lot of records. However, my me being a player, I think there are some songs that slapping sounds good. And no matter who you are, you want to keep in the fold of what's happening. Peg, that bridge there just seemed to be a slapping thing for me. They said, well, no, play with your fingers, you know, something like that. And then you play these songs so many times that after a while, I remember just turning just a little bit either this way or this way, and putting up a partition, and they were about that high. And of course, sitting in a much lower chair, and I remember, you know, slapping. They never knew it went down. They never knew it, except afterwards you can tell there was a difference in that bridge.